Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diane Mann.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I am a bit overwhelmed, to be honest. We have just been in one of the most extraordinary exhibitions I've seen in years. And I kind of wasn't really prepared for it, weirdly, which is also probably a good thing. Because I think sometimes when you, like, know what you're going into, you have a kind of...
A preconceived idea.
Sorry, Russ and I are sharing a mic, everybody, just so you know. A preconceived idea of what you're going into. And then I think you have expectations and, you know, whether they're met or not met or whatever, which is actually probably a bad thing sometimes. And I went in completely blind in a way. I mean, even though I know Joy's work, I wasn't familiar as closely with Ronan's work yet. But we just watched this film that the two artists we're going to meet today have made together in collaboration. And it's one of the most spellbinding, mind-blowing films I've seen. So I'm feeling really overwhelmed, and I'm quite glad we're starting directly after having watched it, because I am genuinely a bit awestruck by it.
Well, that's the desired effect, I'm sure. I'm sure the artists are going to be thrilled with that.
How are you feeling, babe?
I feel exactly the same as you. I'm just really excited that we're going to get to talk to these amazing creative people right now.
Yeah. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art Joy Yamasangi
and Ronan McKenzie.
Hi.
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 Welcome. Well, we're actually in your space, but
we feel very welcome.
How are you both doing?
Yeah, we're good. Really, really good. How are you?
Feeling great.
We're in your space. This is your inauguration show. This is the first show, and this is the space, and we're on Hornsey Road in North London, and your space is called Home.
Yeah.
How did you come to call it Home, and what is it like to have your own space, and how did that come about?
So it's called Home because I had an exhibition 2 years ago called I'm Home. The exhibition was a group show with myself and three other black photographers, female photographers. The show came about because I was really disappointed with the lack of black artists I was able to see in gallery spaces and exhibition spaces. And it's completely different in taking work publicly and in taking work on a screen or on your phone or in the internet or something like that. And I just didn't really understand why it was so difficult to come across artists and to see these artists' work. And I really wanted to put on a show that celebrated black female artists and photographers specifically. Mm-hmm. Also showing the diversity between us, because I've also been feeling that we just get lumped together all the time. And our work is completely different. And just because we're all black and we might all be women, it doesn't mean our work is going to look anything alike. Mm-hmm. And the show really just argued that home and family, which were the themes of the exhibition, were arguably more binding than race or gender. Really just saying that, again, just because we're all black women doesn't mean our photography is going to look the same. So the show was called I'm Home because I also wanted to kind of challenge that notion of art spaces and what that had to be like and what that had to feel like. Mm. I didn't necessarily ever feel particularly welcomed, not completely unwelcome either. I mean, I've gone to exhibitions and galleries my whole life, and they were always fine, they were always enjoyable. But I always felt like I responded to the work more than the space. Right. And I'd been thinking so much more about how a space could influence how I felt and how work is contextualized. So I wanted to build this space for artists, myself included, that allowed the space to add context to the work and situate the work in a way that it would be more appropriate for it to be felt and seen in without having to write on the wall, I'm a black artist, or this is what my work is about, because it might not necessarily be what it is about. Me being black isn't necessarily all my work is about, and the other artists in the show felt the same. So it was with myself, Liz Johnson Arter, Joy Gregory, and Rhea Dillon. And I wanted it to be that lineup as well, because obviously Liz and Joy were artists that I've always admired, and they've been working and been artists for a lot longer than I have. And I think intergenerational conversation is really important. Mm-hmm. And it was also, we've all spent a lot of time in London and in the UK, and seeing how we all respond to home and family through our different journeys and stories would be really interesting to share as well, and to have that conversation, and for the work to be in conversation without us even having to say anything. So the setup of the show was like a home. So I rented a kind of gallery slash yoga space and an Airbnb right next to each other, mm-hmm. and designed the space with sofas. There was a living room. There was like a corner where Rhea's work was, which had some of her, it had her grandma's Bible, the images in the work were of her grandma. And it was like, there was a dining room area where I got a big oak table and we did supper clubs. And
so was it quite immersive, like a
yeah, exactly.
theatrical kind of?
Yeah, because alongside the exhibition, we had an events program as well, where we did like talks, workshops,
so
live drawing.
You curated this thing. Yeah. And so you're, because we didn't know your work before we came to the show today, yeah. to talk to Joy, and then we've seen this film and you're just phenomenal what you've created. But you are a photographer yeah. fundamentally, but also now you're kind of forming a collective, right, and a curator. And
yeah, it's really just about bringing people into the space. I think a lot of Black artists often are like excluded from these spaces and we're not made to feel welcome, and I really want to bring the community together, not only the Black community, but whoever walks through these doors upstairs is the community, whoever wants to use a space, whoever responds to the space, and really to have a place that does have a keen focus on Black and Asian artists, because it's not there. So following on from that show, which was like 10 days long, it had been my dream to make something more permanent of the same kind of vein. And so that's how Home came about.
And it is extraordinary, you know, coming off the street here, we're in kind of, they call it Gunners territory, is that kind of...
You keep saying Gunners, you talk about Arsenal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is guns, isn't it?
I don't know.
I thought their logo was a gun. No, I know, but it has a gun on the logo.
When you say a goon.
I know, but I don't. anyway, coming up from the kind of busy, bustling street into your space here, yeah. it was so inviting and kind of calm and...
It's not a white cube either. I think people yeah. come into this space like you. We're in a space now that is kind of like a white cube, yeah. but you've made it feel like a home. It feels quite
yeah,
massive.
And it's like an environment. It kind of, it's like...
The idea was that I wanted the space to be welcoming. I wanted the space to really be somewhere that you can see amazing artwork. It's an art destination. Yeah. And it's respectful, but it's also homely and it's cozy. And I want yeah. people to sit down and read and relax. And we're also inviting people to work here so people can come and use it as a workspace if they want to. They just need to let us know they're coming. But people can just use the space, because we don't have any spaces. Like, there are hardly any Black-owned galleries or art spaces in London. And there's nowhere that we can just go and be and share and collect ideas. And especially after this whole year, I think a lot of us really want to be connected to other people. We want to be able to share space and have conversations without it feeling so transactional. It's not like, what can I get from you? It's just, these are my ideas. What are your ideas? What do you think of this? And
Thelma Golden's kind of model for the Studio Museum in Harlem is
exactly.
so inspiring. And the fact that yeah, we exactly. spoke to a lot of artists about how that space is missing in
yeah.
the UK,
yeah.
not just in like London. In the UK, there isn't that opportunity to have that.
Yeah, and I was really, we have actually that book upstairs from the Studio Museum, and yeah. I was really inspired by the Underground Museum in LA as well,
yes.
where I saw Deanna Lawson's exhibition
yes.
a year or two ago. Super inspired by that, and seeing her works large scale on these walls where there were candles and there were smaller photographs, and it was so immersive. And we don't have that here, and we should have that. And it's also kind of finding that bridge between a community-based space, because I think community has lost so much of its strength. But like when I was younger, when my parents were growing up, community used to mean we take care of each other, we share resources, we lean on each other. And now I feel like the word community is either help me, I need help, or it's completely commodified of like, these are not my actual friends, but these are people that look cool, so that's what my community is. And it's bridging these two things where this is actually a space that you're welcome and you can come. And that's why it means so much that the inaugural exhibition is this one that we're done together, because Wata is our first collaboration and we've been friends for a long time and we've always wanted to collaborate. And for me, it was like my first true collaboration. Like, we did everything hand in hand. And where I flopped...
How did you two meet then?
How did we meet? I feel like... Do you remember the exact moment?
I remember when we actually met and you took me drawing in Barbican.
That sounds like
I think we just met on Instagram. I think we'd follow each other.
The brutalist architecture, like.
Oh no! Literally,
did
like.
Did you just draw in the Barbican?
Yeah, Joy was like, "I'm gonna go to Barbican to do some drawings of people who were at the Barbican.
Okay, wow. Yeah, that sounds like my kind of activity.
Joy was like, I'm going to go with my friend. Do you want to join? Because we'd just been chatting on Instagram, I think.
Yeah. And Instagram, so I went. Is how we've met. Well, yeah. I've met a lot of artists.
Yeah.
So I would have seen your work. Absolutely loved it.
Same, likewise. Big fan.
And you must have been up for it, the drawing, yeah.
Well, it's not like I draw. I mean, I'm primarily a photographer, but I do a little dabble in sketching here and there. And I was like, well, this is really nice. Like, I've never been invited by someone, another artist, to do something like that. So I was like, okay, cool. Brought my little pen and paper. It was amazing. I really had such a nice time. Just,
it's really chill in there as well, because it's like dim lights. You can just draw like all day. There's loads of people that just come and go. Like, I really like observational drawing, like just like catching someone for a second and just doing a quick squiggle. Don't know where those drawings are now, but it's just
is that something you still do? Is that a part of
your
practice?
Yeah, that's part of my practice.
Just street drawing, like.
Yeah, like, oh, I don't necessarily stand on the street. I like to be somewhere warm. I can do that from like being inside like a gallery, just drawing people, drawing faces. I enjoy that kind of thing. And then like we met up quite a few times after. Mm-hmm. We've done a lot of pub quizzes.
Yeah.
Oh, I love a pub quiz.
We love a pub quiz.
We haven't won a single one
during lockdown. Did you do lockdown?
We did. We did. And yeah. we're not that great at pub quizzes. I would say our general knowledge is quite poor.
Yeah, I would say so. We rely heavily on our partners.
We do, but I think we're not very good at pub quiz, but we're great at other things.
And we're
yeah. But maybe the pub quiz is what brings you together as well.
Yeah.
We just like, I think even though our practices are so different, there are so many similarities in the way we approach things and our characters, and we've always just had such a good laugh and been really respectful of each other, and we wanted to collaborate, but we didn't know what to do, because obviously if it was something photography based, I would completely take over. And if it was something paint or illustration based, you would take over. So we wanted to find a medium where, I mean, I do a little bit of directing, but it's still quite new to me. So it was a medium that we both could kind of explore and share.
Yeah.
But let's talk about this film then, Watta. The title and the colour blue are very important in the movie. How did you both collaborate and come up with that? Because you're both writing and directing it.
Yeah, we did absolutely everything. And I think the obsession with the colour blue, we were like sending a lot of blue photos like back and forth.
Yeah.
Talking about like quite loosely what the colour blue meant to us.
Texture,
before we actually came up with
like
the concept.
Like archive pictures. Yeah, it was all like honestly a really organic, just sending each other stuff that we liked, so we thought the other one might like, whether that was like jazz and high life music, images like pictures we'd taken or textures or just random loads of blue stuff and blue music.
You knew you were going to make something.
No, this
together.
Was before. Well, yeah, we kind of right. always like, let's collaborate, let's
but
do something.
But we never really like sat down and thought about it. So this was just like a casual discussion. And then we were saying, maybe we should meet up to talk about collaborating.
Yeah.
And we did that, and we sat in a cafe.
Not
the Barbican. I think it was a cafe in...
Yeah. Hoxley went to the grocery.
Oh, okay, yeah. I remember just, like, sitting in the back, and we had our laptops. We were there for hours coming up with this very idea.
Well, funnily enough, like, I feel like within the first hour we had the idea, because I wasn't familiar with Mami Wata. So my parents are Caribbean, and...
Can you tell us about Mami Wata then?
Well, all I know is from what I know from you and my research, so you take that one.
Yeah, so I was telling Ronan about how I had a conversation with my mum. I think it was about swimming, because around the time... I think I wanted to go on holiday and I was thinking about swimming, couldn't remember if I could still swim. And my mum was saying why she's scared of swimming and how she'd interacted with Mami Wata. And I was thinking, what? I'd never heard of this. And she was telling me about this mermaid. So I looked into it, and she's a water deity, and she is known like Central Africa, West Africa, all throughout the world, actually, even in the Caribbean, but under different names. I think some places call her River Mama or Yamaya. There's lots of different names that she goes under. Mm-hmm. And so I was just telling you about it, and we were like just researching everything about her. And the idea is that she has all these like jewels and silver and like all these like riches, lives in like several different places and like under the waters. Travelers come by, and she like takes them into her waters, kind of like a typical mermaid, but people
like captivated by her,
like, yeah, yeah, like a siren brings them in. But does she then, what does she do with them?
Yeah, so people who have met her, because there's quite a few like YouTube videos that you can find, and some people have said that their lives afterwards were actually enhanced, like their health is improved, they had an increase in wealth, they generally felt happier. Wow. So it was this weird thing, like once you meet her, suddenly your life has changed. Mm-hmm. Which we,
and people, yeah, have claimed to have met her.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's loads of people who, I think there's some regions which even see her as like a god and worship, mm-hmm, worship her, like seen as like a god of it might be fertility, I think it is.
But I also remember you telling me about how a lot of people are kind of frightened or scared of her, and she's still kind of an enigma.
Yeah,
I'd be scared
of her.
Yeah, people don't really know whether it's, even though they've had good experiences afterwards, they're not really sure whether it's something they should be excited about or something they should be scared of. Mm. And because often she's not always in female form, so we talked about how she can be fluid, or sometimes she represents more masculine or as a man, and sometimes it's more of a woman. And we really liked that aspect of this person or this character that is fluid and flows like the water. And we'd been talking about floating as well, and the importance of that feeling of being carried, and then sort of using that story
the weightlessness of the water, I guess, isn't
exactly
it?
Yeah. Exactly. And the way that water is what bridges us to Africa and the Caribbean, where we're from and where our ancestors lie and where our history and culture stories all come from, and how we've obviously journeyed in a way from there to here, where we are, where we live, where we were born, where we grew up. But so much of who we are and what we are still lies there, and the music that we love, listen to and adore, that sort of African jazz, high life music, comes from Africa, and how that sort of translates into the London scene of musicians who are still practicing very much in similar ways here. Mm. So we wanted to use water as the narrative for, or the illustration to, the journeying of the music and of our people.
Mm. Yeah, that's, I'd say that really well sums it up. Like, even like the fact that those stories, like about her, have made their way all the way
exactly
here,
exactly,
in London, and we're able to like watch this film, like our interpretation.
Yeah, and
of
what's
it.
Really interesting is so many people that were part of the film in the cast on the set, they'd already had their own stories, heard their own stories of Mamiwata, and had their own experiences in a way. And even though they're all from different places, so like you're Congolese, I'm Caribbean, and there were people from other parts of Africa and the Caribbean in the film that had all heard of Mamiwata in their own way. Yeah.
And the film begins with this incredible sequence, which is so like sort of lulling and really like brings you in as a viewer, in water and all the kind of bubbles within the water and this really rich blue. I mean,
and staring straight at the audience. Mm. You're really engaging straight away with us. And especially when everyone's lying on the surface at one point, looking up, they're all looking at us.
That's also was really special that we did, because we wanted to have aspects of ourselves in the work, and we found these ways to bring through Joy's work, my work. So that scene where they're lying on top of the water, yeah, was inspired by two very specific things. It was inspired by a conversation I had with my auntie in Barbados, where she's like, well, at the time she was 74, she can float in any position. And I remember being so like, she looked like she's standing on a rock, but she's floating, her feet are not touching anything. And I remember being so like, how can you do that? Like, what is going on? And she was like, well, if I look at the sky and I'm not worried about dying, I know the water's going to carry me. I'm not going anywhere. The water's got me, so I'm okay. And I really wanted to have a scene of floating to represent this moment that my auntie just feels that if she just lets herself go, the water's going to carry her. She's safe. And then simultaneously, one of Joy's pieces from the
Blue Glass Fortunes, yeah,
the piece from one of your other exhibitions.
It's like this painting, a black background, white figures holding these like blue wine glasses.
Oh, which came from a dream, right?
Yeah, which came from a dream. And this, the scene where you see all the like water souls, mm-hmm, from above, in all in white, is referencing that.
Yeah,
that
we painting. Took the formation from that painting of Joy's.
It was really hard to do that formation in water.
But they all look really comfortable floating, because I was watching it thinking, are they all kind of like holding their stomachs and trying to stay afloat? But it's amazingly powerful. And this film is, what, 5.5 minutes long?
No, that was the shortcut. Our full director's cut is like 13 minutes.
Wow. So what did we just watch?
Like, the full version. The full version.
Really? It felt like quicker than that. No. But that just sums up how good it is.
I think it's the music, so that's also so important.
And how it just splits into different parts. I think that's what makes it feel like it's...
Yeah, there are like key scenes and chapters of the story that we wanted to tell. And we really, it was really important to us that we had music made specifically for the film. And I mean, we collaborated with some amazing musicians. Roxanne Tatai, who's the singer, the producer, I mean, a whole musician who does the opening. I mean, we were both at a performance of hers last year at Swiss Church.
Yeah, that was absolutely amazing
and
to see. Yeah.
It was Roxanne and this type of, I don't even know how to really describe the way she sings. You have to see kind of see the film to understand the depth of her voice, but the atmosphere that she creates through her voice. And it's also completely unexpected, possibly for what, I don't know, what you might think you're going to hear from this film, but her introducing with these deep, rich, soulful sound that, yeah, it's just incredible.
Yeah, I love her. I love her voice. And then after, so that's like the, well, she comes in later on in the film, but in the intro, that's what you hear as you see the blue. And then we have Marcel, who happens to be Rona's brother.
Who's a saxophonist, makes an appearance.
We have quite a few like family appearances.
Yeah.
In the
family appearances, we like to call it.
he plays the saxophone.
And, in that floating scene.
And it's like absolutely stunning. And he worked with Mello Zed, who does the production, a lot of the production. And then after that, we had Biram Sek. I'm in love with his voice.
This is an original track.
Yeah,
it's an original.
And you're going to release this as
a vinyl.
As a vinyl, yeah,
as a vinyl,
yeah,
major.
Yeah. And like, I'm absolutely in love with his voice. It's the the brown scene where you hear
the dream
like
the scene.
I don't even know how to explain his voice. It is kind of like dreamlike.
I mean, I feel like the whole track is quite inaccessible.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then we have the confrontation scene, which is supposed to just zap you out of that dreamlike world and bring you straight into being face-to-face with Mamiwata or face-to-face with your culture and your ancestry and your history and understanding how to respectfully take from that. I think that's a big theme, a key theme for the film is how to respectfully take something from another place and bring it into wherever you are and to kind of love that history, love that culture, but yeah, just be really respectful of where it came from.
Respectful is such a good word because that's actually what it really does feel like. It's kind of really sort of commemorating the past, but also it's very sort of in the present, you know what I mean? Like it's very much now as well. Like it's a fascinating film. I just can't get over the level of detail in it. So like from like the makeup, okay, I'm just going to quickly say a few things, but like the makeup in the water scene where there's kind of blue makeup on the eyes, yeah. And then things like when that scene in the kind of interior space where you've got pillows in the bedroom, yeah, and then you've got all these different fabrics, and it's so detailed though, the complex costumes and surfaces and just elements within it. I can't get over it, including the music. I mean, it's just extraordinary. How did you do that?
Gucci thanks at the end.
A big thanks to Gucci.
Yeah, they helped us out. They helped us out a lot. So they were able to help us in supporting the film and also the clothes.
Wow.
Which,
so how did you pitch to Gucci? How did you get a brand like that involved?
Well, Joy had worked with them before.
Okay. Yeah.
So Joy had an email. It's all about the email.
It's just the email.
we had a treatment. We sent it off and they said yes.
Yeah, we were like waiting quite a while and we just hoped for the best. And we were so happy when like they got back to us.
We just didn't want to compromise on what we wanted it to be. And
did you know the budget as well you needed to make something like this?
Yeah. Well, we had a producer, Julie, who helped us with it and she put a budget together so we kind of knew a rough cost of what to ask for.
Yeah.
How long did it take to film?
The actual filming?
Yeah.
2 days.
Whoa.
Yeah, two days.
Yeah.
Two full days.
That is rigor. That is like organization. Days. I mean, that is so good.
Everything was perfectly planned from like 6 a.m., probably before 6 a.m. Must have been like 5 a.m.
It went smoothly.
Like the end of the day.
I think everybody was so into it. It was an incredible feeling on set because everyone was so happy to be part of it.
The quality of the performances is next level, it's phenomenal. The commitment that everybody is in the moment on screen, it's really, I said, it's so satisfying because you just feel like they're in it. It's really moving.
Yeah, anywhere you look, it doesn't matter who you're looking at because sometimes there's like 10 people on screen at the same time.
You look peripherally and they're all in their moment.
And they've all got such different energies. Yeah. It's like extraordinary.
Well, that was the thing. Abdu, the movement director, who is the musician character, He choreographed everything, and what he was really trying to do, which we saw on the rehearsal day, was just bring out everyone's own ideas of what it should be. So he wasn't like, move your arm like this, do this. He was just bringing out the story of what everyone had inside.
I think he actually said, forget everything that you know about dance and just
be.
Yeah. Like just seeing just them practicing it. As well, they really got into it, and like seeing them get to know each other
it's
a few days before.
It's the eye contact they have with each other as well. They're so engaged. It's
but like... one of some of the performances that we gave Abdu a couple of performances of references that we really loved. Like mine was Sean Kuti, who I think is incredible on stage. I mean, I've never seen him in real life, but I'm very familiar with him on YouTube and the way he moves his body, and just like it just looks like something is coming through him as opposed to him. And then.
Oh, mine was, it's this video that my mum always plays. I'm probably going to get her name wrong. It's Moana Chala. And she's really popular Congolese singer. And she's known for, like, the rotation of her hips, the way that she dances. It's, like, absolutely mesmerizing seeing her on stage. Like, it almost feels like she's isolating one part of her body and then
mesmerizing
singing at the same
is the
time.
Word.
That was one of the inspirations behind the
Why
dancing.
Why does your mum keep playing it all the time? Is it one of her favorite things?
Just a really limited playlist on YouTube. That's really
good. Yeah, I had to watch that one video.
So she's
limited,
really
but gold. Like the playlist that she did for your last exhibition was incredible.
Oh yeah, I absolutely love the music my mum listens to, and like every so often she'll give me songs, and then I make a playlist.
What about your playlist? I mean, your Spotify playlist, I'm obsessed with, which you've released.
Yeah, that's
which
a joint.
Available
yeah,
to, like,
yeah.
Tag into
we just
it.
Dropped in
so
a lot of music.
Brilliant. I'm obsessed with that.
That's all where I was playing in the exhibition as well, for people to hear. Just to kind of get like the wider world of what we were hearing. And
It's just encouraging people to dance. And like even after I see the film now, I feel like I want to dance and just, you know, celebrate.
Yeah,
that's
celebrate.
The feeling.
The final scene, Blue Blue Love, is about celebration.
And actually, it was music that first brought me to your work, Joy, because I am friends with a singer and songwriter and producer called Danae Moore, who has also been a previous Talk Art guest, and her partner Nadira Amrani, who's an incredible filmmaker, and they are both huge fans of yours. And when we first ever met...
Yeah, they live with your work.
Yeah. When we first met, I said to them, oh, do you live anything at home? I think we should do a Talk Art episode. And they were like, yeah, we collect this amazing artist called Joy. And showed me the prints, and they were so good. So you've been printmaking for quite a long time, though, because they're about 3 years old, I think, the prints that...
The ones that they have, yeah, I think the three... Is it the red Jemba print?
Exactly,
yeah,
Jemba,
that's
yes.
Probably, like, 3 years ago.
Yeah.
I think it's 3 years ago. I always remember because my friend was in university at the time, and I used, like, his printmaking in his uni to get it done. And even with, like, the letters, like a lot of people ask me why is it that it says Jemba on it and not gender, and it is really simply because I wasn't great at printmaking and always got the B and the D because you have to do it backwards when you're printing, and I think someone had put the B's where the D's should have been, and so I just kept getting it wrong with every single one. And then I was just thinking, why isn't this working out? And so I just had all these pages which just said Jemba, and then I ended up embracing
you're like, go on, Jemba.
And then
that was invention.
Embrace your mistakes.
Yeah, embracing it. And then realizing that actually, I guess it says a lot about how I feel about gender identity, you know,
it's
as a wider thing. Yeah,
it's fully understand it straight away.
So that's how that print came about, but I'd say the core of what I do is illustration, printmaking, drawing. That's me.
And, sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say the fact that Danae has pieces of yours. I have a piece of yours that I got from a show maybe 2 years ago that took me like a year to frame.
Yeah, I remember.
But that's also links back to what home is about, because I think so many Black people don't have access to artwork in their home spaces, or it's not something that we do, but not in the kind of way that we're doing it, and like seeing your work and having your work and having your piece is like the center of my kitchen, just brings me so much joy every day. And it's a piece that says circles of old forming into a new.
I love that one.
It's incredible, and just honestly seeing it every day brings me so much happiness, and I really want more, especially Black people, to be able to be around artworks that share joy and evoke joy. And Joy is one of those people that makes that happen.
Joy brings joy.
Yeah, well, literally. You really do.
I think, like, being able to own a piece of art is completely different to just seeing it in a gallery setting.
Completely.
It's nice to have it at home living with you, like building a relationship with that.
Yeah.
Like that's something that I want to do too. Like I want to be able to buy more like artist work.
Yeah.
Have that in my bedroom. So.
You know, it's really interesting because when you first started talking earlier, Ronan, about the motivation behind this space and about the physical space, when you mentioned Rhea's work, I know Rhea through Instagram because of Danae and Nadira.
Okay, yeah.
And I've been following Rhea's photography. I think Rhea's incredible, Rhea mm-hmm. Dillon. And it's really interesting to think that actually I've never seen Rhea's photographs in real life.
Mm.
And you're right. It's so important to like leave that you know, digital world and go into the physical and actually make a physical space for, you know, for artists to show their work.
Yeah.
It is really urgent that actually, and I'm pretty happy that you're sort of doing this here because it will grow into other things as well, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I like the fact, well, taken away from that though, saying that Instagram has been an incredible tool. I mean, YouTube met on that. And for you, Instagram is a way of archiving, like a diary for yourself that you actually use and reference to go back to continue your practice.
Yeah, definitely. I would, do you know, it's been really key for me because where I've moved from space to space and the artworks just end up disappearing or I lose them along the way, like Instagram has been the archive of everything that I've made. And not everything is like shown. There's some things I just like archive for myself, but it's been a good way of me like, this existed once, even if I.
What do you mean disappearing though? As in sold or disappearing and they've just been destroyed or
disappearing
worked
over? Disappearing as in maybe something has happened to it in progress, like, oh, no, not progress, in transit, like on the way it's got damaged or maybe I have lost it or maybe I've left it behind. And because I've had quite a few studios along the way. And also I have this habit of where like, if I suddenly realize I don't like an artwork, I will paint over the whole entire thing and pretend that it just didn't exist and make a new piece. And then, like, I guess you could be like, oh, what happened to this old one? And it's like, it used to be what this new painting is.
You need an x-ray machine and you can see it underneath.
Yeah. Yeah. Like some of the ones on display have had probably like, quite like 2 to 3 lives already, so this is like the final.
So it's almost like Instagram somehow becomes like a digital diary or something, like a kind of place to record, you know, the experience of what you've been doing in your creation, I guess.
Yeah, I love it. It's good to have it in that way, and also for the connecting with artists and like all the artists that I know who've now become friends is all through Instagram. That's pretty amazing because I felt like I was just like in a little bubble before, like when I left university.
There's now, some Portsmouth, right?
Yeah, I went to uni in Portsmouth. And then following that, feeling like I know so many talented artists, like literally any single field you name and I'll know an artist that does that. Like you go to a private view, you might go by yourself or to like an opening and you'll make friends there. And I think that's a really like lovely thing that Instagram has allowed me to do.
But didn't you use it as well to channel anxieties from being in Portsmouth?
I did not have a good time at Portsmouth.
Emotional stuff was going on and it was
probably like my Tumblr days, which is like a lot more emo. But I used it in that kind of way because I didn't have a great university experience. I ended up moving. Oh, the racism there. Like Portsmouth was very, very intense. And it felt like I was dealing with some kind of ism every single day to the point that it was a 3-year course. And on the third year, I moved back to London, but I commuted once a month to Portsmouth. I still did really well. It's just I wasn't in. And I think I missed out on that like real like university experience.
Was anybody aware of that, the university, that this was happening or this was the kind of commonplace?
I think, so I had made it known to like the university, but it wasn't just like the course, it was the town. I think there was a bit of like resistance to anyone who wasn't white, really. So I'd get like things thrown at me from the car and I'd like have people call me all kinds of stuff, just complete strangers. It felt like a harsh... like a really harsh reality coming from like London and coming from like a really like diverse class, like absolutely loved college and then being thrown into a situation like that. And I'd never experienced something that intense and having to live with that every day. When I came back to London, I was like really, really grateful to be here and met so many artists.
So fucking sad.
So yeah, it was really horrible. But I think coming from that, like it made me want to connect with like all the artists that are out here and not just saying that it's all in London, but it made me like grateful for all the art that is going on. Yeah. And like find a community like a proper community on Instagram. So
and did it channel into your work, your practice, this experience of Portsmouth? And
oh yeah, definitely. I think that's what got me into like writing about my everyday life. Like I would make like illustrations and comics about the things that would happen, and then it then ended up becoming paintings and drawings, and then realizing that what I can offer that is different in terms of my art is just talking about my everyday life, even if it's just like combing my hair or brushing my teeth or whatever it is, just talking about my everyday existence. And I think people seem to like respond well to that.
Yeah, because it's very domestic, some of your images, like you're looking in a mirror in the bathroom as you're saying brushing your teeth. You create these images that are very universal and recognizable but kind of private.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it also feels very intimate sharing all these like artworks that are about my life and then having people see it in a gallery setting. But in this kind of setting, it feels a lot more like I don't feel like everyone's looking at my life.
Well, you're sharing it with a friend as well.
This
collaboration.
Yeah, and it's great. I mean, like we've been talking about this since I think it was last year that we've been talking about the exhibition, the output, and to actually see it come to life, like I still feel giddy just thinking.
It's a massive achievement.
But also the film you did first, and then out of the film the exhibition kind of grew. So the seeds of the exhibition that we've just experienced is directly from the collaboration you've made. So you've both gone away and individually made your own work, separate from each other, but on the same kind of trajectory, knowing you're about to do this joint presentation. So they're kind of together but alone, the actual artworks.
Yeah,
I mean, It didn't really actually feel like I was ever alone in the making, because we constantly send photos back and forth, like behind the scenes.
Like, I love it because Joy's always like, oh my God, can I send this to Ellen? And I'm like, obviously, I'm assuming you'll send Ellen everything anyway.
Yeah. We send a lot of things like back and forth. Yeah. So it never felt like I was making this like on my own. And I think that's quite a nice thing to have done this together. And
yeah.
I imagine that we're probably going to collaborate on quite a few things.
100%. Yeah, I mean, we're already like
really well together.
We're already talking about things.
So your photography, how do you find the models for your photographs, and how often are you photographing?
I mean, it's a mixture. Sometimes I work with like models from agencies. Often I work with family. My mum's a big part of my work. Friends. Quite a lot of time I'll find one person from a family, either through street casting or a model agency. And then I'll find, do you have any siblings? Do you have a mum? Do you have a dad? Do you have...
Or a lot of Jordan as well in the film.
Jordan, my cousin's in the film, or my brother's in the film.
Have you photographed Joy?
Not yet.
Ah, well, that's the next collaboration.
I mean, we've talked about it before, though. I've asked if I can photograph.
Have you illustrated Ronan?
that's what needs to happen there.
Oh, well, there you go.
Well, I want
your photograph, your illustrations over the top.
That could be a whole other show. It could be like you presenting each other.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yeah.
Well, I asked Joy if I could photograph you and Ellen because a lot of my work is about family or relationships, tenderness, kind of showing those sort of black relationships.
Who's Ellen?
Oh, Ellen's sorry. Her partner.
Joy's partner.
And Ellen would definitely say yes to this, by the way. So Ellen's like major Ronan McKenzie fan. So
Ellen's a big fan of your work?
I would, yeah.
I mean, Ellen must be your biggest fan.
Yeah.
You'd hope Ellen would like Joy's work. That could be a problem, otherwise.
Sorry, we should have mentioned who Ellen was, just been chatting about her. But yeah, so we're definitely going to continue collaborating. I mean, even just having this friendship for me has really expanded my world and my vision, and having somebody to always share things with. And like, yeah, again, even though our practices are completely different, I think having like a creative partner in a way has been really valuable.
That's definitely what it feels like. Yeah. I mean, there's been like, I guess, a lot of like famous artistic duos, and yeah. I feel like we might be onto something. So that's how I feel like.
Definitely.
It's just fun to do. Like, I actually have had Same. Fun throughout this whole entire process, yeah. from planning to the very end, and I feel like even if there's been times where we haven't been on the same page, we're very good at, like,
yeah, I think that's what was quite surprising, like, is because we don't always agree on everything, and we definitely have different points of view, but it's always been so smooth and easy, because if one of us is like, I'm not sure about that, and the other one's like, well, I think it's going to be really good, then we're just like, okay, let's go for it. So there's never any tension, and that's really special, because
you're happy to compromise for each other.
Yeah, because yeah. we believe in each other's yeah, visions.
Like, I love your work, so I totally trust that if Same. You're like, we should do this, then yeah. it's coming from, like, your experience, and I totally trust that. So.
Yeah.
We were talking Likewise. To Thomas J. Price recently, and he was talking about this idea of, as an artist, you kind of often feel quite uncomfortable, and it's the uncomfortable situations that can propel you forward mm. and to make, you know, to be challenged, and not just to be said, yes, it's great all the time, actually does mean
you... The uncomfortable is a really good medium to work with.
Yeah, so I guess having each other as a critic is quite an interesting thing to propel you forward, like, and to push each other.
I don't know if I'd use the word critic, because we're both like, oh my God, that's amazing! Oh, really? We're both just like, oh my God, this is great.
Champion,
it's definitely yeah. championing. And actually, I would say something different to what Thomas has said, okay, because, yeah. well, a lot, as I said, all my work is about love and joy, and aside from my, like, personal work, I do commercial work where... Mm-hmm. Which is my income, and in that I've had so many challenging situations, similar racism, and just like also just dumb situations, fickle people, and people who care too much about fashion and stuff like that than how people feel and caring yes. for people
yes.
and actually I feel that I thrive best in a loving scenario, and my best work is created when there's love and there's people caring for each other and coming together. So yes, I agree that those uncomfortable situations can propel you, but I feel that love can propel me more.
I definitely agree. I think that this film is definitely love. Like, we had
yeah
like yeah we had like your cousin
yeah
in the film,
and she's not a dancer. She I just wanted her in it, and I was like, you can dance, right? And she was like, I mean, yeah, I can dance. And I was like, okay, so I'm gonna cast you as one of the dancers for this film. And she turned up to rehearsals and she was like, oh wow, you really meant dance. But
she was great though.
She was amazing,
and she really like I guess like bloomed in the film. And
yeah,
then we
she
also
did.
Had like Ronan's brother doing like the audio.
Just yeah. sister do makeup?
Yeah.
She did.
Yeah,
my she did hair. She did hair.
Hair, yeah, she does makeup on the side, but she did hair in it.
Yeah, and, yeah, she did.
Like
hair.
Even like her being part of the project, mm-hmm. I think made it more special.
Definitely.
So yeah, it was Definitely. Nice to have all the people that we like love in this.
Oh, there's love, a lot of love going into your
Yeah, place, yeah. 100%. Because I don't know, I think when there's love, then there's space for those sort of criticisms or mm-hmm. conversations where you might not agree, but because love is at the core, you just make something happen, and you respect each other, and that's really, really important.
One of my favourite moments in the film is the combs that you see.
Yeah,
and
so that was another collaboration.
They're amazing, absolutely amazing.
They're broken at one point, aren't they?
So yeah, that's Joy BC, who we collaborated with, because Joy BC is an artist and specifically a jeweller, and she had done this whole project about combs, and I went to see them last year, I think.
Joy
BC.
It's all joy. It's all love.
Exclusively.
It's about joy.
Yeah. I didn't actually notice that, but that is very true.
Joy BC is an artist, yeah, and a jeweler. And I went to see her in her studio, and she showed me these combs, and I was straight away blown away by them, but mainly because of my experience with my hair. We're constantly talking about hair, and the hair doing process was really, really painful for me as my whole childhood. It was like something I would just, a terror. I had dreadlocks. I had locks for 10 years. I got them when I was 13 because the whole hair process was just horrible. So when I saw those combs, I said to Joy, like, I just feel like this is really special because the hair won over the combs, over the pain of what they mean. And that's why they have the image upstairs, hot comb, of the young girl with the two combs in her hair.
Yes.
And that whole story, which was in Luncheon magazine, was about my experience of my hair and what that means to us. And the combs in Wata were the first iteration of that exploration and that collaboration with Joy BC.
And that colour of the combs
yeah.
is such an exquisite colour. Mm-hmm. It's actually the colour that Zoe Bedeau, in our interview with her, said was her favourite colour. You know when you see like...
A lichen?
No, it wasn't lichen, no. There's a, you know when you see like metal outside that's changed colour and it's gone to a special kind of greeny blue turquoise. I can't remember what the colour's called, annoyingly, but there's a really specific word, and that was what it made me think of.
And that's really perfect for the whole idea of these jewels that Mamiwata has and the importance of those and the journey of those, because the process of doing that, it's not like a quick process. That's something that needs time to make the combs that colour, and they have their own life and their own story in that process.
I think we couldn't actually touch the blue ones because what was
poisonous,
the reason? Yeah, it was poisonous. We had to handle them with gloves.
Exactly. So for some people's skin, it irritates. You can't touch them.
Wow, it's intense.
Yeah, it's intense.
There's something about the kind of power of an object and the way that the object itself can have a kind of life or a soul or a, you know, there's a whole thing in Japan where objects often are seen as having their own kind of life force and history.
And then they repair them with that gold seams, which makes them more beautiful. So that broken object then becomes even more elevated.
And there's something about that concept which I related to in the film for some reason. I kept thinking about it as I was watching it. It's quite like an ancient thing, like a connection to kind of ancient like objects and stories. And
yeah, well, yeah, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
So how important is colour in both your practices? Because I know for you, you say that your work is bright colours, faces and black lines. And
yeah, it's very important.
That's a good summary.
So vibrant. And obviously the colour blue, it feels like in the photographs looking upstairs, whether this is one series we're seeing or if that is throughout your practice.
Yeah, it's also really important in my practice. We really align because we're both obsessed with blue, but we also work with brown and white. So those are the themes that I kind of work in. And I sort of got really interested in brown maybe a couple of years ago when I started shooting medium format, because I could take close-ups of skin in the way that I'd never done before, because I'm not like, I didn't train as a photographer or anything. I just sort of picked it up and I'm self-taught. So when I got this medium format camera and I had a 90mm lens on it, just the texture that I could see in the skin.
What does medium format mean? What's that?
So, I mean, this is my very non-technical explanation. It's just a larger format than 35mm. So it's not the largest. There are bigger formats, but it's quite big, so you can get so much more
detail.
information from the image. Exactly. So when you shoot it on skin, you can get so much information and texture. And I think with our skin, it's something that, I mean, brown is something that's really heavy. Brown's a really heavy color because it has so many connotations already. And through my work, I'm really exploring the extent of brown and the textures and the tones and how special, how rich, but also how full of trauma it is. And then pairing that with white, which is traditionally the color of purity, is a play that I'm really interested in and we're really interested in within this film.
Yeah, for me, it's just blue, really.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I think yours is, when I think of your work, I do think of the colour brown and skin.
Yeah.
And
I think that's the clothing, the brown, like the clothing at the end, the kind of domestic scene, they're all in different shades of brown.
Mm-hmm. And even the beautiful carpet you've placed beneath us right now.
Yeah.
It's a gorgeous brown.
Yeah.
You know, No, you go.
I was just going to say that brown was rarely something that's celebrated, rarely a colour that's celebrated, rarely a colour that anyone actually even thinks of is a colour. And I think that's so kind of really explains how the way that we're seen and the way that our skin colour is seen in society. And it wasn't until I read Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race, honestly, that I started to break down some of my own prejudices that I had towards myself and other black people.
Internalised racism.
Yeah, completely. Completely.
Like what?
Like, why would I walk down the road and if there was a group of black boys, cross over, but if there was a group of Asian or white boys, not cross over? Things like that.
I think a lot of us have that kind of internalized...
completely.
Like, racism that we haven't... Like, some people are working on, some haven't.
Yeah, we grew up with it as well. So, like, being light-skinned was desirable, being dark-skinned wasn't desirable. Mm. Having that light, bouncy, golden, mixed-race people hair that you see in adverts and television is what was desired, so... When I was younger, until I was late into my teens, I would always wear sun cream and try and stay out of the sun because I wanted to be lighter skinned. And
you're also told that by elders as well, to keep out of the sun.
Exactly.
You know, make like you refer to certain hair textures as good hair and others as bad hair. There's a lot of like self hate that is like
perpetuated.
Perpetuated sometimes by the people that are closest to you.
Yeah.
You know.
Exactly.
And actually, when I see your work, I feel like it does the complete opposite for me. And it's actually made me really love the color brown and like want to be surrounded by it actually. And like,
me too.
I do also want to get a full brown outfit.
It's coming.
Just from seeing.
You've like, got brown, like,
I wore this just for Rona.
Well, so my boyfriend is Portuguese and he always loved brown, just like, not in a, that kind of way, but in a color way. He always wears tans, he loves wearing browns, and it was never something that I would ever do. I didn't have any brown in my wardrobe. I just wouldn't do it. We just don't think about it. And actually, through being with him, being more comfortable with my skin and seeing my beauty and accepting that through my photography, through accepting and seeing other people's beauty, has made me have so much more love for myself and the color brown. And now I've started making clothes and almost all of them are brown.
Did you make this what you're wearing today?
Yeah,
you did.
Yeah, I did.
It's extraordinary what you're wearing today. It's thank so you. Beautiful, so elegant.
Thank you. Oh yeah, so almost all the clothes I'm making are brown. And
so I guess art is therapy.
Massively,
for
yeah.
And for you, Joy?
Yeah, definitely.
You found your way through the diaristic approach to making art is therapy.
Yeah. I mean, it's all that I do and what I enjoy. And when actually after writing or painting, I immediately feel much better. And it's just like a way of communicating when I don't always have the words. Like, I haven't seen myself as being like that super articulate art student. Even when I was studying, I wasn't that great at forming up all these essays, but drawing and painting, I just felt comfortable saying what I want to say just through visuals. That's how I've always been.
I feel like we're always forced to explain ourselves as well. I mean, I feel like this, especially as a black artist, always have to explain ourselves, always have to be like, over conceptualize everything just to be taken seriously. And I think through an art practice, the work can speak for us and we don't have to say anything. We don't even have to say what it's about, it just speaks, and that's quite peaceful.
Mm. The artist doesn't need to be present. It's like exactly. The work speaks for itself.
Yeah.
Like even with the film, there's no like speech.
No, there's speech.
It's just music and movement. The movement speaks for itself, and like you don't have to necessarily understand the full story of what's going on.
Well, we even kind of wanted Biram, who's speaking Wolof at the end. We love that we don't know what he's saying. We can't understand it. And that's the beauty of it. You don't have to understand it. You just feel it.
You sort of know what he's saying. He's not saying something offensive.
No, yeah. Yeah, we know it's not offensive.
We know it's in
theme. We know it's on brand.
Like, someone watches
it, doesn't that, and they're like, ooh. Yeah, it's definitely in theme with the project.
Yeah.
So poetry's, you are a poet as well.
I would never describe myself as a poet.
But you write.
Yeah, I do write. I think it's just because there's other people who do it and they love it and they're really great, and I just never see myself as a poet. It took me a really long time to even call myself an artist.
Do you have poems like on the tip of your tongue that you can speak whenever?
Not really, no.
So you couldn't give us a little poem now?
I knew you were going to ask that. No, I definitely... I'm just not that kind of person. Like, I think... Growing up, I've always been a really, really shy person. And actually, for a long while, my parents just said I just didn't speak. So it's like poetry doesn't really suit me. It's always just been painting and illustrating and drawing and like communicating what I want to say through my art.
I just saw an incredible poem through you, though, by Audre Lorde called Black Unicorn.
Oh, yeah, I know. Which is,
would you read that out?
No, I wouldn't.
Could I read it?
Yeah, you can read it. You can read it. It is amazing.
You're an actor. You can do this.
I actually have quite a few of her books as well.
You sure you don't want to read it out, Joy?
I don't want to read it out.
Go on,
you
Joy.
You do it, Russ.
Okay, go on.
Go on, Joy. Go on.
But not if it makes
I want to hear it in your voice.
Okay.
I'm suddenly now conscious of my reading voice.
No, you sound
You've got a beautiful voice. We love your voice.
Oh, thank you. The Black Unicorn. The Black Unicorn is greedy. The Black Unicorn is impatient. The Black Unicorn was mistaken for a shadow or symbol and taken through a cold country where mist painted mockeries of my fury. It is not on her lap where the horn rests, but deep in her moon pit growing. The Black Unicorn is restless. The Black Unicorn is unrelenting. The Black Unicorn is not free.
Thank you so much for reading that out. Sorry, I just sprung it on you, but that was so worth it.
I actually have her book as well, the collected
it's
poems.
It's called The Black Unicorn, the collection of poems, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what was it about that poem that spoke to you, and how did that channel into your practice?
I think I actually just really got into her work during university. I think that's probably most people who know of her work, it's usually around that time. But her writing just feels freeing. Her writing is just, I've never ever read poetry like that. When I was in school, poetry was very different. It had like a set story to it, or it had like a rhythm and rhyme. It didn't have that. And I like that about her works. I think there's so many like poets now who are doing some really amazing things. So like one poet that I love, Abundance Matanda. Do you know Abundance?
I love Abundance.
Obsessed with her. She speaks like the people that I know, and her writing just feels so real. It doesn't feel like it's been pushed through like a university or a gallery or anything. It just feels raw.
Yeah, it's raw.
But it is so rich in the way that academic pieces are rich. It has that depth. It has so much depth. I mean, Abundance of writing, for anyone who's listening to this and doesn't know it, needs to know it.
Is there one piece by Abundance that you would recommend to read to start, or just...
Well, an essay that I really enjoyed was The First Galleries I Knew Were Black Homes. The title was something...
That's the most iconic
Does that play with the title here then in some ways as well?
I mean, it's definitely... That essay has definitely been influential to me, for sure. Actually, I met Abundance because they came to my first exhibition 5 years ago, and it was like, I didn't know what I was doing. It was supposed to be a joint show with someone who knew what they were doing, and it ended up being a solo show, and Abundance came and gave me a zine, which I have upstairs, actually, with a friend of theirs, Alameda, who has a zine, Utes of London. And then after that, Abundance did a poetry book called Bearfuckeries, which everyone needs to have. I have it upstairs.
Bearfuckeries.
Oh. I have it upstairs. You can check it out.
Cool.
I mean, her poetry is just, it's sick.
Wow. I've never heard of it, but I'm really excited.
Yeah, you can check it out.
Another discovery today. You currently have Joy, an exhibition in Manchester at another space called Home, which is not related to this.
No, we're not related.
Which I also love, though. There's lots of positive
Joy
spaces
Joy
called Home. Yeah.
Joy is only having shows at home.
Yeah,
Joy
that is true.
Can you talk a bit about that show? Because I haven't seen it, obviously, because of lockdown. I wish I could see it. But when I saw the images from that show, it made me really want to talk to you for Talk Art, because I think that exhibition looks extraordinary, like next level extraordinary.
Thank you.
I mean, this show is too, so you've done two extraordinary shows, but can you speak a bit about how that show came about?
Yeah, so that exhibition is called Blue Glass Fortunes. I actually exhibited it here in London once before, but it was for such a short amount of time. But in Manchester, it just feels, I haven't been able to actually see it because of lockdown, but it feels like it's at home. That series of work was completely based off of dreams. I know it's going to sound ridiculous, but for that period of time when I was making it, I would wake up and record the dreams that I'd had, which, like...
On voice notes,
yeah. I was too tired to write it, so it just was practical. And the whole series came from a dream. It's like a dream within a dream. So I had the idea in a dream, woke up and thought, okay, I'm going to start making this, which is, I probably like lost you completely.
cool. I love that.
But the very first painting is called Blue Glass Fortunes. And it was a dream that I had where I remember it was a really dark ballroom, and there were these like blue wine glasses scattered around the room. And in those wine glasses, it was like a candle, some kind of light. So they were like illuminating the whole entire room. And there were people dancing. This is actually the painting that we reference in the film with the overhead scene. And that is what started like the whole series of them like having a dream and then painting it. Having a dream and then painting it.
Sections of text as well, which we can sometimes decipher, but they're never completed sentences.
I think that is me often running out of space. it's just the way that I work. Like, I just get so into the moment and then writing, and my sense of space, just of what's left on the page, doesn't always work out. And then I start again from the top. So actually, it's best to read it from the bottom and work your way to the top.
But there's a lot of motifs that appear in your work. So the blue glass, there's a blue mirror, but a lot of people are in very boxy suits. And I came to your work through Paul Smith, a collaboration you did where you made three clay ceramics, and they're all in Paul Smith striped boxy suits. That's a really interesting concept that goes through all your work. What is the suit?
We were actually just talking about
that earlier, because people are coming to the show, and I'm here every day, obviously, and people ask me lots of questions about Joy's work, and most of the things I know the answers to, but what are the suits about is something that keeps coming up, and I was like, look, I need to ask Joy because I don't know.
Yeah, so we were talking about you call them like Congolese dandies. They dress up.
Is it the zoot suit? Because there's an artist called Troy Mitchie who we...
Oh, some of them wear like zoot. Well, they wear all kinds of suits. Yeah. But it's a very like popular like lifestyle where you wear like your best suit, bright colours.
Right, yes.
Pinks and yellows, everything. Like bowler hat, stick, like pointy shoes. Like people really take fashion seriously. I would say that 70% of my family dresses like that on my dad's side. So, the suit I just love. I was saying that if I could, I would probably wear a suit every single day. But yeah, I think
that's... Do you have a suit?
I don't. And I think it's because I want to get something that is fitted properly.
Yeah.
And for me, a suit doesn't feel like a banker working kind of thing. I think when you take it out of that context of like upper business. Class, like business kind of look, and you put it on someone like me, it becomes completely different. Probably a bit queer. And I like that, yeah, you know, queer. That it yeah. suddenly, like any gender can wear that item. Like it's not exclusively for, you
it's
know,
men.
It's
not binary. And you identify as non-binary.
Yeah,
so that,
yeah.
And that plays into your work.
I would definitely say that the suit is that, and like everyone in those paintings are wearing suits. It's not meant to be clear what their gender is, and it's actually kind of irrelevant in most of the pieces. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they all wear suits, and that's how I would like to be in an ideal.
So when Russell discovered you through the Paul Smith collaboration, you had created some kind of ceramic sculptures, which also have your illustrations and paintings on the actual ceramics themselves. They're so exquisite. And he sent it to me, and because I originally knew your first artist name, which is Joy Messi, which is how I discovered you through Danae and Nadira, I didn't put it together. And then I suddenly clicked, and I was like, Russ, I know about this artist already. So we got really excited. So I kept discovering your work through different sources. But can you speak a bit about these ceramic works? Because they are so good.
Yeah,
you've been working with a lot of ceramics as well, aside from that, haven't you?
Yeah, I think... I describe my work as mixed media because it's constantly changing what I do. I like figuring out a whole new medium, like panicking a bit because I don't know how to use it, and then just seeing where it takes me. And ceramics is one of the things that I've been continuously interested in, like making things out of clay, the feeling of actually molding and shaping something from beginning to end and then firing it is just something that I've like brings me so much joy to do. And earlier in this year, I worked with Chris Bramble Carter in Carter. Is it Chris?
Yeah.
Have I got it right? Yes.
He's the dad and a
yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's a family thing actually. Yeah. They've got both the twins. I think they do ceramics. But working with him was like really, really great. I learned a lot. And actually, one of the things that I remember is him constantly saying, with gusto, with gusto. Because I would just be like, they're really like working really slowly, trying to get this done. He'd be like, okay, we need to speed this up.
Is that the hard line that goes through your painting, I guess? You like the solid black line, the outline, to be clean.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted it to be absolutely like clear and perfect. And also, I didn't want it to explode in the kiln, which like he'd gotten into my head that one small chip of like plaster could just... make everything explode. So I was taking it really seriously. And I learned so much about ceramics from him and my time there. And that series that I'd done for Paul Smith, that was using air dry clay at home instead because of like the lockdown, there were certain restrictions. And it was a different making process, but still very therapeutic to do. And like, I would recommend that everyone try that. Just try and buy like a small bit of air dry clay and see what you make.
It's amazing the increase in spaces for making ceramics now and clay objects. In Margate, we have a space called Clay Space, and they do a lot of amazing exhibitions in the window. So it's a really small studio, but in their window, it's a shop front, and they have a little shelf. And then every week, you can see a different artist who's been practicing there, does a little mini exhibition. It's so cool. But I really loved those works, so thanks for talking a bit about them. And then one other thing I really wanted to mention is in your film, the lighting is so extraordinary. And there's that one scene where you have all these different coloured lights kind of on the surface of the models and dancers' skin. And it is just one of the most extraordinary
shots that I have seen in ever, really. I mean, it's amazing. Can you speak a bit about how your approach was with lighting? Because that must have been so difficult to pull off somehow.
Oh, you have to talk about Beatrice.
Yeah, Beatrice. So Beatrice, the cinematographer, is... I've been working with her for a few years and she's amazing because we are really new to film. So many ideas we have, we didn't really know how to execute it. So Beatrice will be the one to come in and be like, this is how it's done. And actually that was quite simple because we knew we wanted it to be really dark and we just wanted the light to be the color to be the focus. But interestingly, because we shot almost all the film except the underwater scenes on film, analog, we couldn't actually really see what it was. So we just obviously asked Beatrice what we wanted. And on set, it was more like, guys, this is an idea of what it's going to be. Don't take this seriously because this is not it. So actually, only once we'd finished filming and we sat in the edit, we saw how it came out.
Was that really nerve-wracking?
No, we trust her.
Yeah.
There was one moment where I think we weren't sure if it recorded properly. Do you remember?
Oh, yeah, because shooting on film, you have to check the gate and see if there's hair in the thing. And so many times me and Joy would be like, yeah, we're done. And then the guy was like, no, we need to do it again. And that was really difficult because... especially even with my photography, like I don't overshoot. I shoot on film and I shoot really minimal. And once I've got it, I'll move on. So I'm very quick.
You're
and I just.
Dark room as well, do you work in?
No. So actually, it's interesting you ask because I realize there are so many parts to a photographic process. And the part I enjoy is the shooting. So I don't scan my own film. Mm-hmm. I go to a lab, Chan, in Shoreditch, which is amazing, give them my rolls, and then I just get the beautiful surprise at the end. But anyway, so I always. Yeah, once I've got it and I move on. So actually having to repeatedly shoot scenes and get the energy up of the cast and like be like, okay, guys, we just need to do this again was...
frustrating in some ways?
New.
It was new. Right. Yeah, definitely new. I felt like I'd learned
a
lot.
Diplomatic way of saying frustrating.
Yeah. You get frustrated, don't you?
Hell yeah, especially this hair in the gay stuff. And
yeah.
You do a good shot and you've been screaming and crying and they go, we've got to go again.
Exactly.
Like, why?
Well, especially in that final scene where it's so high energy.
Yeah.
And to have to do that a couple of times.
Oh, God, yeah.
Oh, I actually enjoyed that when we were doing it because it had so much energy.
Do you remember
we were
running out of time? And the first AD kept being like, this is it, we're doing it again. And I was whispering in Joy's ear, let's do another one.
I was literally like, down with my shot because I was like, okay. And you were like, yeah, let's just do another one.
It was because initially in our shot list, it was quite rough and we just wanted to be quite spontaneous with it. And at the end, we were never supposed to have Mami Wata and the dancer together dancing in the middle.
Yeah.
So that was something on set we really wanted to do. And we were running out of time and they were like, we need to leave the studio. And we were like, let's just do another one. And Joy's like the diplomatic one. And I'm like, I really want to do it. So it was, yeah.
Oh, well, it's amazing. So how much longer is this show up for, Wata?
It closes on the 9th of February.
Okay, great. So, and then what next for you guys? Or what's the next show you're going to have here? Because now you're like curating a space.
Yeah, the next show we have is from an amazing British painter called Cece Phillips. And it's her debut solo show. So that's really exciting.
Okay.
And her work is, again, colour-based. And she uses colour to... The show is called I See in Colour. And she's using her experiences of what it means to be black and British to her. And... how comfortable she feels in this ground that's supposed to be ours because we're born here, but is it really? And she's using colour to explore that and explore kind of hidden histories. So that's the next show that's on here.
And what about for you, Joy? What's next? Because you do a lot of collaborations as well, right?
Yes, I do. What's next for me? My intention is to rest.
Joy was like, I'm going to take a month off.
That's what I want to do. I just want to not work for a while. Like, just not do anything.
Mm.
Just relax. And I think from those periods is then when I feel inspired to make the next series of work.
I think solitude is such an important thing for artists as well. You know, to have that space for yourself so that you can then open up and take yourself somewhere new with your creativity.
Without any pressure of having to create.
Yeah, that's what I want to do. I don't really work well just like sitting down thinking, what am I going to make next? I have to actually just... go and see art, watch movies, do nothing for a long time, and then the idea will come to me, sometimes in a dream, sometimes not.
So on that topic, we ask every guest we have on the show two questions. One is, if you could do an imaginary art heist and go and steal any artwork that you wanted, it could be a building or it could be anything you want, basically, or an object or anything, what would it be and what would you take home?
Oh, I know what I'd take. I feel like we'd take the same mask.
We already had this conversation. Kerry James Marshall.
Oh, yeah, which one? Yeah. Do you know which painting? And where did you see his work?
I don't know the name of the painting that I'm thinking of, but it has two people dancing and then a record player and like a really colourful rug and the music notes.
Yes, yes,
that's
yes.
The one that
notes are actually drawn across the canvas. Yeah.
And I would take the one that is like looking through the window of a woman sort of maybe changing, maybe dancing, spending time on her own in her room. And I think I saw it at David Zwirner.
Yes. About 2 years ago or something.
Yes, like exactly. And actually, what's really lovely is somebody from, well, one of the directors of David Zwirner was here on Thursday and sent us some gifts of some really amazing art books.
Not Rodolfo, no.
Yeah.
Yes.
He was here. He came with Francis.
Oh.
So he came with Francis and then he sent over some amazing
books.
So
generous, yeah.
Which is, it's just so special, I think, because one thing that I really want to do here is have more conversations with other galleries and make it more of a sharing type of experience. And I would love other galleries to respond to the shows we have here and have those communications and connections. So to start, I mean,
this
obviously...
This has to be a part of the conversation. It will be.
Exactly. Yeah. So to start that with that amazing gift of some beautiful books... it's just really,
because you're
really
building a little library upstairs.
We have a library. Because also that's another thing, like, where do people access amazing art books and where can they just go and flick through them and touch them without having to necessarily buy them? Because a lot of them can be quite expensive, especially books from Black artists.
Yeah.
So we have two curations. We have our normal home library and then we have a special curation from BB's Books, which is a book club amplifying the voices of people of colour, artists and writers. And so BB's Books library will change with every exhibition, so it kind of responds to the show. And she's starting a physical book club in January here, so I'm really excited to have that.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
You're very inspiring. The other question we ask is, what is your favourite colour? Which I think we know the answer, but...
I just looked at you. I actually am torn between yellow and blue.
Oh.
I think I'm going brown.
Amazing. Well, yellow and blue feature in your work a lot.
Yeah, they do.
One of our favourite paintings upstairs. We love the one that's yellow background. It's
the dance.
So
the dance.
Yeah.
Dance.
The hair in the dance.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with like yellow, blue.
Also, your other...
Sometimes red.
Your
well.
Other Instagram.
Oh, my yellow Instagram.
Joy's got a yellow Instagram.
What? Do you mean?
I put
is it low-key?
Private, but it's like really... It's just like yellow...
Things.
Yeah,
things,
yellow things pictures. That I've just seen.
It's amazing.
Just taking a picture.
What's the handle for that, or is it private?
I've made it private.
Okay.
I might actually delete it and make a new one.
Okay.
About blue. Yeah, I'm rebranding.
Or maybe just make another one, so that when you come back to yellow, you can just activate it.
I just go through colour phases so quickly, so I'm just not sure.
I love that. Well, that goes into your diary approach to everything. That's fantastic. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I think you're both extraordinary human beings, and I am so grateful that we got to meet both of you, because I just think you're both amazing.
Thanks
and Joy, I love
you.
Your work so much. And
me
Ronan,
too.
I am so happy that we've just discovered your work today, because you are an extraordinary photographer. I mean,
thank you.
Incredible work.
And this space is really, really exciting.
Yeah. So everyone listening, please go see this show, because I think it's going to change your life. And I'm so happy. So what's the address here?
So the name is Home by Ronan McKenzie, and we're at 397-399 Hornsey Road.
Perfect. And what's the nearest tube?
Nearest tube is Finsbury Park, but you've Archway, really close by. And then overgrounds, you've got Crouch Hill and Holloway, like 5 minutes walk away.
So you have no excuse if you're listening to this and you're in London or you're visiting London,
you head over there.
We've got an Instagram. Yeah. It's home_by_RonanMcKenzie. And then the website is homebyrm.com/. I'm lying. Oh
and
my
do
God.
You have your own personal Instagram?
I do. It's Ronan KSM.
Okay. And Joy?
It's @ Joy Yamasangi. Should I spell Yamasangi?
Sure.
Let's spell it. Mm-hmm. So it's JoyYamusangie.
And we will link to all of your Instagram and your website in the episode notes, but also on our Instagram and now Twitter, because we're @ Talk Art Twitter. Who knew? I mean, I'm not very good at Twitter.
We haven't got TikTok yet. But...
No. Imagine me and you on TikTok. It'd be hideous.
You would love it.
I've never been on it. I'm so old. Thank you. It's been a privilege. And lots of love, everyone. We'll be back very soon.
Thank you.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram @ Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.